Welcome to a new episode of Outside the Panels with your host, Johnny the Machine Hughes.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Outside the Panels. It's been a while since we've had one of these shows, so to mark our comeback, we have got a super special guest. We have to talk about the new release of the Billionaire Island Trade Back. We have writer creator Mark Russell. Mark, how's it going? You okay?
Yes, good. Good to see everyone.
Excellent, excellent. I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed Billionaire Island. What a fun read!
Thank you.
There's a level of dark humor in there that just really appealed to my British sensibilities, I guess.
Yeah, I think that the humor, the darker your story is, or the more sort of darker the realities you're talking about, the funnier it's going to be. I don't know how that works, but somehow it does.
Indeed, indeed. Tell you what, let's start at the top and work our way down. All right, so a question that you must have been asked a bazillion times. All right, how did you break into comic books? What was your first foray and step into comics?
Well, I don't want anyone to like listen to this thinking this is like how a good way to get into comics. This is like a duplicable experiment.
There are all very many, very ways.
There's no wrong way to get into comics. There's just no real right way to get into comics either. But for me, it was my Count Chocula fan fiction that I was writing on Facebook, and which just happened to be seen by Marie Javens, who's now the editor in chief at DC Comics. And at the time, she was looking for somebody to write a reboot of the comic book Prez, which ran for about three issues in 1973. Mm-hmm. But they didn't really know who would write that sort of satire, who would write, like, because, mm-hmm. If you write a funny comic, then no one really wants anything to do with you. So they didn't really know what to do with this comic that was, they were intending to be sort of satirical. So they had to look outside the box a little bit. And she just happened to stumble upon my Count Chocula fan fiction and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a comic for DC. Now, that wasn't my first experience in writing, though. I had written two books before that, which she was also aware of. So she knew that I could write and that I could write a prolonged title. She wasn't just shooting in the dark. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was actually what did it for me. That was my beginning in comics, and it's where I've been ever since.
How different is it writing for books as opposed to writing for comics? Obviously, this is the visual element in comics that you've got to sort of cater for. So how do you go around that kind of that difference there?
Well, the big difference is that people will actually wait till they've read a book before they decide they hate it. Whereas they pretty much make up their mind about a comic the moment it's announced. So, which has not really been kind to me, because all of my ideas sound like really bad ideas on paper. But in terms of the writing, I really love it, because it gets rid of all the things I hated about writing, or the things that I enjoyed the least about writing prose, which is all the scene building and all the description of the physical environment. Now it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to an artist, and I just have to give them some brief notes about what we're sort of going for. Mm-hmm. And then I can completely scrape it off my plate onto their plate, and that frees me up to like write the things that I want to write, which are the metaphor for the reality that I'm complaining about, the one-liners and the dialogue of the characters.
Cool. So basically, you're a delegator. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sort of the middle management of comic books.
Cool. You know, I often think, and I ask this all the time of the various writers that we've had on, is when you write a book, do you end up kind of being the de facto assistant editor, because it's your story and you kind of want to see how it, you can put a brief description down. So for Billionaire Island, it could be, I want a desert, because there's a desert in there. And then when it comes back, you think, well, that's not quite like the desert I wanted. Or do you become a bit of an editor in?
Yeah, although less in terms of the artwork and more in terms of my own writing. because I feel like the soul of writing is really rewriting. I'm much smarter and much wittier if you let me go back and change what I said 13 times. So that for me, that's where I think the gold is in the hills for writing, is like going back and combing it over. And I like writing far in advance too, because to me, it's not till like I've finished writing something and like forgotten about it for like a month or two that I go back and I see what everything I did wrong the first time. So I like being able to sort of like, you know, like age a wine. I like to be able to sort of put it in a drawer and forget I ever did it, and then come back to it a couple months later before the artist has ever laid pencil to paper rewrite it again. So, because then it suddenly everything comes clear to me, like, oh, I should have done that, or oh, this would be so much better. Mm-hmm. So that process, what you're describing, is like, well, you know, this really shouldn't be a desert. This really, or this is a, you know, not a very cinematic setting. Those sorts of things occur to me before the artist even sees it. Cool. And then once that process has begun, where I'm working in conjunction with the artist, that the rest is all kind of up to the editor. Okay. It's like I pretty much am just the editor of my own sort of self-doubt.
Okay. So basically you're saying humor is 2020.
Yeah, right. You know, everybody's smarter in retrospect, I think.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes we hit those home runs, you know. And speaking of home runs, I think there's some absolute corkers in Billionaire. I absolutely,
well, thank you.
There's some characters in there that I double take just because I was like, really, you're getting away with this? So and some of the other sort of like inspirational bits in there, the characters that are kind of inspired by other people. So for example, the female reporter, it's Lois Lane, right? Basically.
Sort of, although she's Puerto Rican and sort of, I think it's different than Lois Lane in that she's less of a, she's more of a street journalist. She's actually sort of inspired by Nellie Bly, hence the name similarity, who is a famous stunt journalist in the early 20th century. And she would do things like pretend to be insane so she'd get locked up in a women's asylum so she could write a story on the inhumane conditions in insane asylums. Or she would get locked up as a prostitute, even though she wasn't obviously a prostitute, to just sort of do a story on what it was like to be locked up as a prostitute. So I wanted to bring that sort of commitment to gritty journalism to this character, which, you know, Lois Lane has. But I think Lois Lane is more like sort of the classic journalist, the classic reporter, where she's doing investigative reporting and is like sort of like, you know, doing the you know, making phone calls and hitting the pavement, as opposed to like the sort of stunt journalist that I was writing about.
Yeah, cool. I think you're right to an extent. I think Lois Lane has probably changed. She's probably changed more over the last 10 years than she's ever been in like the 80 odd years she's been around.
Oh, I like Lois Lane's a great character, but I wasn't really trying to channel her when I was writing Shelley Bly.
Okay, cool. Excellent. I sit corrected. Thank you for that. When we talk about inspirations, there are a couple of characters that I just want to talk about. Mr. Cantor. Where did he come from?
He's sort of a composite of, you know, tech billionaires and sort of investor billionaires, like billionaires who don't really... capitalists who are primarily interested in the movement of capital as opposed to like actually creating something.
Yeah, cool. So there you go. There's a picture. Hopefully you can see. There he is doing his promo for the island. Hope everyone can see that. There you go. That's taken from the book directly. Great. Cool. Other characters. The one that kind of really made me smile. It wasn't the guy who lost his wife, the Punisher. The Punisher.
He's not a feel. Yeah, Trent Arrow's not really not exactly a feel good character.
No, I liked the. I'm just a junior executive, and I'm here to do this, that, and the other. And I was like, bless you, cotton socks. She was class. I've got to ask, where did she come from? Because
Again, most of what I write about is sort of metaphors for people or types of people or archetypes in a lot of ways. And she's sort of the archetype for the lean-in feminist, the feminist who thinks that, like, capitalism is there to work for her.
Okay.
And also, I think, is in a larger sense, sort of the stand-in for most of middle-class America, where we know we're prisoners. We know the system isn't built for us, but we think there's got to be some reward at the end because they keep paying us. So clearly they're going to let us go at some point.
Yeah. Do they? Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, how many other metaphors do you have going on from this book? When you look at it, when you look back now, you've seen, obviously the book's been through its issue run. So you've had the singles and now it's the trade paperback collection. When you look back, because you planned so far in advance, do the characters now seem surprising to you?
Yeah, I think they do. They seem like and I like the fact that they work sort of both as archetypes and as sort of their own unique things. I think to me that's kind of like the key to a good character is it's archetypal, but not so archetypal that it seems like a cliche or it just seems like predictable. It's got to have something unique about it that stands on its own, but it can't be so unique that it doesn't have any relatability to what the readers are experiencing in other people. So for example, like Business Dog was kind of based upon this article I'd read that said that like most money managers and hedge fund managers underperform the market as a whole, meaning that you'd be better off like sort of getting your investment advice from a magic eight ball or a randomizer than you would from these highly paid professionals who own private islands. So I thought, well, if that's the case, then why not just have a dog set in front of like different bowls and let the dog, whatever bowl they eat out, that's the investment you make that day. That's what you choose to do.
You see that often, though, that every time there's like a major sport event, there's always some animal that can guess the future. Like, who's going to win the Super Bowl? Let's go and ask Sid the Squid. Sid the Squid, you know, to give him two footballs. Yeah, one says Niners, one says Dolphins. Which one's it going to be?
You know? The hilarious thing is that people see that as like sort of like a testament to the oracular powers of the animal rather than the random reality that we're all sort of like caged in.
Definitely. I remembered when I was reading the book and the scene where the dogs choose them from the loads of different bowls. It reminds me of a story of a guy, a true story. Well, allegedly true. It's in the newspaper. So, you know, take your pick. Is it on? Is it not? And a guy got arrested for maltreatment of his dog because he'd gone away for a week. And then he put out seven bowls of food, expecting the dog. Right. Just like to eat one bowl and then go per day, but of course it's a dog.
I wrote the days of the week on the bowls. That one's clearly marked Monday. I don't know why the dog ate them all at once.
And I'm like, well, a cat would know. A cat would be able to do that. So maybe you need the next time around, you need a shrewd investment cat.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, cool. The dog is, I've got to say, absolutely one of my favorite bits. Unbelievable. I was like, that was very, very good. How was it working with the artists for the book? Because you had Steve Pugh, who is, dare I say, a classic artist. It's a classic Vertigo sort of mature style artist as opposed to someone who's a little bit superheroic. So how did that go? How was that working?
Well, it worked great. I've worked with Steve before on the Flintstones, so we knew each other well, and we knew, I knew how to work with him, and I know that he gets my sensibility. And we're working with each other again on the DC Future State series, Superman vs. Various Lex. So yeah, at this point,
so which book are you doing on DC Future State?
Superman versus Imperious Lex.
Oh, very good.
Set on the planet Lexor. But yeah, I work well with Steve, and Steve, I assume, works well with me. But yeah, I think part of the magic of Steve Pugh is that he has just the right sort of quotient between sadness and goofiness in his artwork. Yeah. The artwork always looks a little surreal and sort of goofy, but the facial expressions of the characters always betray this sort of really subtle sadness or defeat, which to me really humanizes all the characters that he draws. Yeah, and it's right there. You just picked a panel, and it perfectly demonstrates.
Yeah, so the guy there, that was 3 years ago. Yeah, he's like, look at those eyes. Look at that frown. You can see he's proper down in the dumps.
He does that so extremely well, and to me, it really becomes the soul of the book.
Definitely,
People somehow internally knowing that this is a fraud that's been perpetrated on them, and yet they have no choice to believe because they've invested everything in this fraud.
There's pages, there's loads of characters that are so interesting in this book. I'm just going to see if I can just quickly zoom through, because where is he? It's the gentleman with the mannequin.
Oh, yes. Falco Jakes, architect who built Billionaire Island.
That's right. And I'm saying that's right, like you don't know. Yeah, because you know, you wrote the damn book. but for me, where are we at? There, I've just seen the panel that I want. Yeah, there it is. Give me 2 seconds. Share the screen. Chrome. Boom. There you go. That's the cover for the, I think that's the cover for one of the chapters prior. But the character is just so, he reminds me a lot of Logan's Run. You know how Logan,
right. Desert City, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so Logan's Run is that element, the original movie, we're not talking about the TV show.
He's like the Art Carney character who's like outside the sort of utopia. Like
exactly.
Acting crazy.
Yeah, because he's got his robot and everything. Yeah, exactly right. And when I read this, I was like, oh my God, this is like, that's it. That's exactly how I look at it. That is kind of Logan's Run, isn't it? You know, that crazy sort of, I've done something to survive type of mentality.
And to me, the role that Falco Jakes plays in the story is he's sort of the exception that proves the rule. Uh-huh. He's the character that sort of shows you why people don't rebel against the system, because mm-hmm. to live outside the system is to live, you know, off of IKEA furniture that drifts up to the shore and having to build a mannequin wife because there's no one else outside the bubble with you.
Yeah. I mean, that bit where he says goodbye to his wife, I know it's not supposed to be. I know it's not supposed to be heartbreaking. It's supposed to be of a comedy moment, a bit of like a, hey, look at the crazy guy. But for me, I was like, that is so sad. That was on it. I was like, oh my, I can't believe that you've gone that route.
And that was intentional. I wanted him to have like a real emotional connection to her, that, you know, we are sort of like, we need these emotional connections, whether we have to project them or not, mm-hmm. that this is ultimately what makes us human beings.
Yeah. Cool. And it was just really touching. Really, really touching. It's kind of,
thank you.
It reminded me a little bit of, I don't know, around, I'm going to go old school, Detective 601 to 604, A Mud Pack Story. One of the Clayfaces, the third Clayface, has a dummy, and you take the dummy off him. He goes crazy. He goes ballistic, you know. And it's just this kind of whole thing that goes on. So I love that whole kind of that lost love. You know, the guy knows he's lost something, and he's trying to find it. You know, and it's a crazy place.
One of the things that draws me to the comics medium is that you can express so much just with like the way a character, the look on a character's face,
definitely.
Or just sort of the landscape that they're in. It's like, and it's just sort of a beautifully artistic form of minimalism, just to express something with a vista or a look on a face, as opposed to like, you know, a paragraph.
Yeah. A lot of my work colleagues give me grief for being in the comics. You know, and I'm like, no, it's not about, there's not a lot of writing in it. It's like, it's not about the words. Look at the art. Someone has to direct what that looks like. Someone has to get the feel. So, you know, if there was, you know, if the sound effects going on, the sound effects build to something. They're not just there for nothing, right. You know? So, you know, we sound like two pretentious comic book fans when we talk about this, you know, right?
No, but I think that is it really does open up this dimension. There was a Dan Clowes story where he sort of expresses this more eloquently than I am, but he talks about how prose kind of like is all about the interiority of your mind and sort of like experiencing something in your mind as like sort of this pristine ideal reality. And then like sort of film and TV are like all this external, like you're just watching something that's happening outside your mind and you're just sort of accepting the information as it comes in. But comics is really half and half. It's really about absorbing the external visual information, mm-hmm. but then also reading in your mind and sort of forming this sort of, you know, reading the narration and the captions and forming this sort of, you know, working through it in your own sort of creative capacity in your mind. And he says that this is probably how the human brain actually was evolved to work.
Yeah.
As a balance between the two, not entirely one or the other. So it is probably the medium that is most closely adapted to human cognitive ability.
Yeah. Okay. I totally get that. It's one of those things where I'm a big, I know I'm Brit, but I'm a big American football fan. And back in the day when I used to play over here, someone used to say to me, how can you throw a football? I'm like, I don't know. I just pick it up and there it goes, you know? And when someone says to me, how do you read a comic book? It's like, I don't know. You just pick it up and you start in that corner and you work your way down. It's, you know, I don't analyze it too much because I think if I do that, it's like it becomes.
Yeah. It seems like the one medium you really don't have to explain too much because it's so natural.
Yeah. Just relax into it. Yeah. Definitely. We talk about comics. So what sort of books are your books? What books do you like?
Oh, wow. Well, there's so many. A friend of mine, Greg Means, and his writing partner, M.K. Reed, put out a really amazing graphic novel in 2019 called Penny Nichols, which got nominated for an Eisner, but it was put out by Top Shelf. But I love that book, and I try to tell people about that one. And also I'm reading Eric Schanauer's sort of history of the Trojan War, Age of Bronze. I'm reading that right now. They just released a colorized version. And one of the things I love about it is that I'm sort of a history buff, and he's gone through great care to like sort of recreate the historical, what the costumes, what the sorts of things people would have historically wore in Greek society in like year 1200 BC. And he sort of seamlessly weaves in like Greek mythology with the story, which is kind of hard to do because he's trying to tell the story as he's trying to tell these Greek legends as history. So the way he sort of gets around that is that he doesn't necessarily have Zeus or Neptune or anyone, Poseidon or anyone show up, but the beliefs, the Greeks' belief in these gods and their belief in like the sacrifices is very real. And so it's really more about the impact of belief on the war than the gods themselves. So it's pretty fascinating and really richly detailed rendering of the Trojan War, which I recommend.
Cool, excellent. So you write for DC as well. How different is that then? How different is it going from DC to an indie book and back across?
Well, there's good things and there's deficits about both. The good thing about writing the creator-owned property is obviously you don't have to check with continuity. You don't have to worry about an editor telling you, no, this character you just invented would never do that because you're making up the reality as you go along. And you don't have to worry about stepping on the toes of some other writer who wrote the character 30 years ago. So that is a plus, definitely. But at the same time, what you lack when you're writing a creator-owned character is the cultural equity that gets people to buy into that character. For example, when I'm writing the Flintstones, everybody knows who the Flintstones are. I don't have to go into a lot of character development for Fred Flintstone or.
And did the modern Stone Age family.
Yeah. people know, and I'm more likely to get people to read it who don't know who I am just because they're familiar with the Flintstones. Whereas the only people that are going to read Billionaire Island are either going to be, you know, wowed by the cover art, Steve Pugh's great cover art, or they're going to be getting it because they are looking for a comic that I wrote or Steve drew. So we don't have that cultural equity to borrow upon when we're putting out a creator-owned property. But we do have absolute freedom, which, you know, more than makes up for it, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you have the point where, on one hand, you are buying onto the property, so basically people are going to pick up, you know, a Superman book or a Batman book or a Flintstone book. Yeah. The negative is that you've got to leave it the way it was because the next guy down the line is coming. Yeah.
And I'm pretty happy with what DC has allowed me to get away with. I think there's this sort of like rental car philosophy at work where the more they see the property as a rental car, as opposed to the crown jewels, the more likely they are to just let you sort of like play with it. Okay. So for like the Hanna-Barbera characters, which they didn't really own, they were like, yeah, go crazy, do whatever you want. But the closer you get to the crown jewels, the more you start writing like in the Batman or Superman universe, the more protective they get of what over what you can do with them, which is understandable.
Yeah, to a point. I mean, the recent announcement, I think, is that after Future State, DC going to pull back on continuity. So I think the Black Label shows how well you can have something like Three Jokers, for example, run alongside Batman 100, and it's accessible to lots of different fans.
I know the continuity is why a lot of the hardcore collectors buy the comics, because they want to have this Talmudic understanding of the DC universe, and they just want to know where all the rules lie. But I think for the most part, the continuity gets in the way of good storytelling. And so I think the more they can pull back from that and just allow people to tell stories using these characters, not worry about where they fall in terms of the continuity, the better comics you're going to make.
I think, you know, I kind of agree with you. I do. I'm on your side of this fence. The geek in me, you know, the collector in me, I want to know when that happened. Did it happen? Is it the real thing? Blah, blah, blah.
No, there are a lot of people out there that really want, they read it for the canon. They read it like the way people watch like General Hospital or something. They want to know what's happening in this story, in this overarching story. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I
think you need to have these other approaches to the character where it's like, this is outside continuity. This is like, this is just somebody telling a story based upon these characters.
The things that kind of my sensible head kicks in, you know, my gray hair head kicks in and says, well, hold on a second. You know, if Batman was solving crimes, he's not going to shoot it to God, solve a crime every single night of every single day for a whole year. You know, that was crazy talk, you know? And just because it takes you 6 months to get through, I don't know, whatever 6-issue story that's coming out, doesn't mean that the story, the actual real-time story, took 6 months. That could just be a day. It could be 2 hours. It could be whatever. Right. So then
he would work more like an actual police department where he's got all these files. And, like evidence coming into the files at different times until he puts it all together.
Yeah. So for me, it's like I'm always – my internal battle is always I want to know where it fits versus, well, it can't fit anywhere because there's just too much stuff going on. So in the end, I sit back and just read it and enjoy it.
That's all you can. That's all anyone can ask of you.
Yeah, I don't get into the whole, like, did this happen, did that happen? And, you know, if DC make a statement or any comic book company makes a statement and said, this event happened, whether it be Mary Jane and Peter's marriage getting wiped or whether it be Barbara getting shot by the Joker, boom, that's fine. Just, you know, I guess for me, I want markers. I don't need everyday continuity. I just need markers to point the way. Is that kind? That's probably a better way to look at it. I just need markers. So that's fine.
For me personally, as a writer, I'm less interested in the soap opera. I'm less interested in, you know, the grand canon of these characters than I am using them as sort of thought experiments. Because like, if I had that power, what would I do? Mm. Or if there was a social situation like the one we have now, how would a Batman really approach it? How would a Superman really heal the world when, you know, there's like the ability to fly can only get you so far. Yeah. X-ray vision can only do so much in terms of like fixing global warming.
You've hit an absolute nail on the head. We recently did a show called the Old Timers Comic Book Show. So it's myself and a couple of other guys. We talk about books that are a little bit older and the big classic books. We recently talked about a Superman story in which Clark Kent overhears his next door neighbor beating the hell out of his wife, and he can't do anything because she won't press charges. You know, and that shows you how unpowerful, if that's the right word, Superman can actually be, because he's stuck within the rigidity of the law, as it were. You know,
that's what my comic Second Coming is largely about. Like, a lot of it is about is like sort of how useless a lot of these superpowers really are, because they aren't going to solve the everyday problems that we face, and nearly as effectively as something as basic as human empathy will do.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the superhero Sunstar, you know, he is the most powerful hero on Earth, and yet his grandmother is succumbing to dementia. He's powerless to do anything about it. Him and his wife can't adopt because technically he's not a human being. He's powerless to do anything about it. All the real problems in his life can only be solved by getting somebody to like have mercy on him.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that you're not into the soap opera, but it's that secondary nature, that secondary day-to-day environment in which the superheroes are actually powerless. You know, it's things like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You know, as soon as she picks up the stick, she's going to get the vampires sorted. But it's how she gets through the day with all the other stuff going on. You know, the kind of has resonance for me, I suppose. You know, and Spider-Man's a perfect example. You know, as soon as he pulls on his mask, you know he's going to whip or do whatever he's going to do. But it's Peter Parker that interests us, not Spider-Man.
Right. It's like Slavoj Žižek made a point about Jaws, and his point about the movie Jaws was that it was like, because it was like sort of the first blockbuster, the first sort of movie that made hundreds of millions of dollars in the theater. And his point was that because societally what we were going through was a lot of social upheaval. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, a lot of like the gender equality issues that were playing out in the Equal Rights Amendment. We just came out of the Vietnam War, Watergate. There was, you know, counterculture that a lot of older Americans were struggling to understand and deal with because the culture had shifted so radically in the last 10 years. And he said that the reason why Jaws was so immensely popular was because it swapped all these hundreds of challenges and issues for like one very physical issue that we could all recognize and identify with, and it allowed us to like sort of like return to this sort of moral simplicity of like saving ourselves from the threat we can see and identify. I think in a lot of ways that's what, you know, comics sort of do, is, and I think it's what they superhero comics have traditionally done, is they've allowed us to take these sort of complex issues and sort of bend them into something we can actually understand, bend them into something that we can act, give us the catharsis of feeling that we are, that we understand the world.
Cool. That's a great point. Great point. Do you think that, all right, so here's a question that sort of linked back to a previous one. DC's current idea of moving away from continuity, do you think that is because they see how well the independent market is doing and they think to themselves, well, you know what? Obviously, I don't want you to burn any bridges with your contracts or stuff you've got going on, so that's fine. But do you think that that has an impact on how they approach things, where they see things like, you know, Billionaire Island doing so well, and, you know, there are characters that they've got. I mean, DC had Vertigo for ages, but now a lot of those indie writers, like people like Ram V, are cropping up on Justice League Dark and on Catwoman, you know, and you've got a lot of indie artists coming across. Do you think that sort of them saying, look, continuity doesn't matter, is a way to entice some of these indie creators in to start writing more metaphorically than just, you know, Batman versus a bad guy?
Yeah, well, continuity really matters to like the traditional sort of retail model where you have people going in, you have like people are really into comics, either into the DC or Marvel universe, going to comic book stores to get the latest issue of like the Avengers or, you know, Iron Man or whatever. But for the younger readers, for the new readers to comics who are going to not necessarily comic book stores, but are going to like Barnes and Noble and buying graphic novels, that is not really that important at all. What really matters is like telling a good story and having new sort of independent voices in the medium. And so, I'm not surprised that they're going, it doesn't mean that they're abandoning the continuity and it just means they're expanding. And if this is where the writing is on the wall, like if you know, this is where the room is for expansion, is in attracting children and new readers to comics, by telling these sort of self-encapsulated stories that you don't have to have read 500 issues of Justice League to understand.
Yeah. Do you think that I apologize if I ask this question, because I know Billionaire's Island isn't the audience that this is aimed at. So apologies for putting you on the spot on this. But do you think that the kid comic book reader is that a fallacy now? Are people that are coming into comics, is it people who are a little bit older, a little bit more mature? And that's why so many of the comics now tend to have that element. Because, I mean, in my local comic book, I can't remember seeing anybody under the age of 16 in there.
Yeah, and I think this is why, you know, the younger readers, they're definitely buying a lot of the new graphic novels, which is why, but it's because they're targeting so many of these the new graphic novels at younger readers. Like, who sells more books than Raina Telgemeier right now? And those are the books that you don't necessarily have to go to a comic book store to buy. Those are the store you can buy at Barnes & Noble. So yeah, you're not seeing a lot of kids in the comic book stores because they're buying these other books. They're buying, you know, Raina Telgemeier, or they're buying, you know, Mariko Tamaki books.
Great writer. I love her. Yeah. I love her. She's class.
Yeah, both of them are great writers. And that's really, I think, where the future of comics in terms of, like, how you're selling to the people who aren't already, you know, going to the comic book stores. That's where your market is, really.
Cool. Excellent. Right. Back to your book. Let's talk about you some, shall we? Billionaire Island. When I looked at it and I read it, we've talked a little bit about Logan's run in there. I want to say because of the control and arc of it, my initial thought was it's a little Westworldy, but without the fantasy. And when I've thought about it, I'm not sure if that's an accurate way of doing it. But I think it's probably the other world nature of it, because you've got the standard of living, and then you've got Billionaire Island or Freedom Plaza, you've kind of got that going on. Is there elements of that in there, or is that just me kind of?
I can see it. It wasn't really intentional, but I can see it because they're both about fabricated realities. Although in this case, it's a fabricated reality they don't use to escape the reality. It's the one they try to make their own reality, or maybe it's the reality they're trying to escape is the death of the world. But this isn't the idea that they're going to go back to the world, but this is where they're going to come wait out the end of the outside world. So I could definitely see the parallels. I think you can make parallels between any sort of dystopia or sort of technological sort of anti-utopia with that, but it's based upon like actual things. Like there's a lot of billionaires who are buying private islands or buying, you know, bug out bunkers in New Zealand to escape the end of the world, which is probably much more cost effective than them actually using their billions to try to save it. Which is what we always were told they would do, right? We were always told, well, you know, it'll trickle down, or, oh, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, and they're going to make sure that, you know, we're all taking it. No, they're going to buy a private island, and they're going to buy 100 years worth of, like, frozen yacht food and just wait for us to fight over the rest.
There's a touch of sarcasm in the book that I'm sarcastic by nature. That's my humor level. The bit that really tickled my fancy, as they say, is the debate and what to do. And they say, right, so what we can do is we can release the food product, and some people will die, or we could do this, and then some little voice says, you know, if we just get the billionaires to pay a certain percent more in tax, the world will be saved. And they're like, yeah, let's go back to plan A. I was like, oh man, that is actually it. You know,
that's the reality we're facing, where all of these problems are solvable if we just had the political will to take the resources of the world where they are and solve them.
Yeah.
But that's unfathomable. We can't possibly do that. We have to like start thinking about who we're going to throw under the bus. Mm-hmm. And right now, in our current state, with everyone sort of dirt sliding into like fascism and nationalism, we think that throwing refugees and immigrants to the wolves is going to be what solves the problem, but it's not. It's just going to delay the inevitable choice for who to throw to the wolves next.
That's exactly it. You know, there's, and I'm not going to say this is a slight against anybody, but there is always the bigger fish, isn't there? No matter where, I mean, don't get me wrong, we're big fish to somebody. There's going to be people looking up to us and saying, oh man, I wish I was like the machine talking to cool comic book dudes. You know, and there'll be people looking up and say, oh man, I wish I was like Mark writing cool comics. You know, we're big fish to people, but for us, there's always like the people that were bosses ahead, or, you know, the next big comic company, or, you know, even as far as you go up, there's always a bigger fish getting ready to throw somebody under a bus or point the finger and say it's your fault, or, you know. Right.
Imagine you're in a lifeboat with like a dozen people, and you know, you decide to eat the least popular, the person with the least protection in that lifeboat, so that you can, the rest of you can survive. Well, until you start actually making a plan to row to the shore, you're just going to gradually one by one be eating everyone on the lifeboat until the last person wins the grand prize of starving to death.
Yeah, you know,
so there really is only one choice if we're going to continue as a species, and that's to paddle for the shore.
put that on the campaign slogan.
Right. We can't hope to survive just by, you know, hoarding and cannibalizing each other, because eventually we're going to need to get out of the situation.
Cool. Excellent. How far, you mentioned earlier on that you write so far in advance. So you write your first draft, it sits in a drawer for a couple of months, pull it out, have another look at it, give it a polish. Then when you're happy, off it goes to the artists and editors and so on.
Yeah.
How far in advance then did you, also how long ago did you start working on Billionaire Island?
Billionaire Island was completely written in 2019. By the end of 2019, including the rewrites and stuff.
Cool. So you're a fast worker.
Well, it took me about 6 months to write, but yeah, it was 2019, and then Steve started artwork in, I think, early 2020, and then it hit stores in March of 2020, right before COVID hit.
Yeah.
So there was like a 3 month delay between issue one and issue two.
Yeah. That's kind of happened for loads of people. My comic book shop, because we've had like national lockdowns here, my comic book shop was closed for that whole period. When it finally opened, I had like £140 worth of comic books to pick up. I was like, oh, really? Honestly, yeah. It's like, what?
That's probably, you're probably good to have that, so you can not leave the house and, bunker with your comic
books. I've still got a whole pile of them to read. I'm like, you know, I think I've got like something like 6 months worth of Justice League Dark to go through. You know, as much as I'm up on Batman, I haven't read Detective. I have no idea. I know 1027's come out and we're on 1030. I haven't hit 1020 yet.
That's a good problem. So, I love that when you get like a backup of a backlog of stuff that you love to catch up.
Really? Really? You want to see it? There you go. Don't know if you can see that there. That is my backlog of stuff to go through.
Yeah, that's pretty
pretty backlogged to tell. Okay, right. So last couple of questions, I guess. When it comes to Billionaire Island and the metaphors that you have on there, do you think there is scope for a sequel? Do we get to see what happens down the line with some of the characters who have survived? I'm not going to give the game away of who survives, because the book's out now. You should go and read it. So I'm not telling you anything. But is there a chance for... Because, you know, the ending is quite... I'm not going to say hopeful, but there's an element of realism in it. And like, they recognize the paddle of the shore metaphor that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. But yeah, definitely, I think there's room for a sequel. And what I would want it to be, I've actually had conversations with my editor, Sarah Litt, about what a sequel would look like. And I think it would sort of follow two main storylines. It would follow a cult that builds up around Business Dog, because he controls so much of the world's remaining wealth. And also the solution, the element of hope. Like, this is like what human beings are doing to try to save themselves from the coming calamity.
Cool. So the two would then have to kind of
fit. They're sort of about the two polar choices we have, which is to sort of like venerate a bygone age, you know, until we all become sort of memorials to the past, or to try to build something new, which might allow us to continue to live and, you know, to adapt to the world.
Cool. So I will just give the guys a quick view. There you go. So this character there, that's what's his
that's Business Dog.
The Business Dog. There you go. That's the chairman of everyone who owns everything. Bless his cotton little socks.
Yeah, and that headset is Bluetooth enabled, in case you're wondering.
Oh, there you go. check out the Bluetooth there, yeah. Because, you know, if you don't have any internet, it is pretty woof. Oh, yes, I went there. Yes, it's a bad joke. I'm sorry. All right, okay. So up next for you is Superman in the Future State book. You looking forward to that?
Great.
Yeah.
That's coming up. I also got some other things I can't really talk about because they haven't been announced.
Fine. But another
project with Ahoy.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Ahoy. I've spoken to a couple of people from Ahoy. I love their books. I think, you know, Ahoy are very diverse. And what I mean by that is they do different types of books. You know, it's not like, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but, you know, you've got like a business model like Aftershocks. You know, Aftershock, I love Aftershock comics. But once you get past that initial Tales of the Unexpected twist, you're kind of like, okay, what's next? At least from my point of view. But Ahoy, I think they're putting out some really good comics recently. So,
I love all the titles. They're really good at curating their line and picking good projects to put out. So,
cool.
I'm excited to be part of that.
Cool, excellent. All right, so there you have it, Mark. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us talking about your book and your thoughts on the comic book industry. I really do appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for a great book. Billionaire Island, the trade paperback, is out now. Go check it. You can get it from Ahoy. You can get it from, I assume it's on Comixology.
I don't know. I don't think yet, but I think it comes out in a week or two on Comixology. Right.
There you go. And I tell you what, why don't you do it the old fashioned way? Why don't you take a trek down to the comic book store, have a look in there, go past the mainstream stuff. You know, there are other books out there that other than Marvel and DC, as much as I love DC, you know, but go check them out. All right. The trade's there. The issues that might be there, you know, the COVID stocks have meant comic books are holding on to more stock than they used to. So go check them out. All right. Okay. So all that's left for me to do is say, don't forget to check out all the other podcasts that you have available on the UCPN. And this is Johnny the Machine Hughes saying adios.
Visit UndercoverCapes.com for the latest and greatest podcasts via the Undercover Capes Podcast Network. Also visit our parent company website, ComicCrusaders.com, all about comic pop culture.